Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Thank you, Terry, for taking the time to talk to us. I would like to ask, what is New Frontiers, actually?
Okay, thank you so much. Well, New Frontiers is one, I hear you speak of it as a big organization. From my perspective, I've been obviously with it from the very beginning when it was anything but. I had been at Bible College and was invited to become the first pastor of a new young church that was gathering in a town on the south coast of England. And they'd just begun, they'd never had a full-time pastor, and would I become their full-time pastor? And I'd been converted out of a non-Christian background completely. My parents were not converted till much later, and I never saw an open Bible at home, so I had no background at all, really. And when I became a Christian, I had the privilege of hearing John Stott. First time I ever heard anybody preach was at All Souls, Langham Place, recently led to Christ by my sister. And everything was new to me. And I started going to church, and I got nearly all of my friends to church just once. I couldn't get them to come again. And that troubled me, that actually church seemed rather remote from my generation and from my contemporaries who had no Christian background. We're not used to this culture of church going, which had on the wall, "Don't speak in the sanctuary" in my local church. And although the pastor was a beautiful, effective, mighty preacher and a lovely man, the culture was that you didn't really relate to anybody. You shook the dear man's hand at the door when you left and you saw him again next week. But it was quite hard to become part of that culture and to learn. And completely, as someone who needed so much to learn, I was disappointed that now, looking back, I can see we were not doing any of the one another verses that are so evident in the New Testament, like praying for one another, encouraging one another, confessing your faults to one another, having a life of integration. And my pre-Christian experience was very integrated with a group of friends. We would talk about everything and anything. Late into the night, we were very close friends. And I found that to become a Christian was to become, for me, an isolated individual, not part of a community, which I found very difficult. I found life extremely lonely because I stopped going to all the places I used to go to because we went there to sin together. And if I was going to make a clear stance, I'm afraid I had to stop going, which meant I was an isolated person. Now, at first it was exciting from the point of view that I was shown you could know God as your personal savior. I'd never heard that language before. But then I began to learn. You do your personal evangelism, your personal devotions. You knew God personally. And it was locked into the individual. Christianity was locked into the individual. Gradually, as I read and prayed, I could see in the Bible that there was a much more corporate emphasis on being a believer. You were together with all the saints. You were caring for one another, which was not my experience. And so when I became a pastor, I said to the people who invited me, would you become our first pastor? And I'd met these people, and I liked their evangelistic zeal. I liked their desire to buy land, put up a building. Not many people were doing that sort of thing in those days. This was the late 1960s, a long time ago. And I liked the people. We liked one another. And they said to me, "Well, look, we know you preach the Bible. We've heard you preach. If you can lead us from a biblical perspective, we'll embrace the changes that you want to make," which we agreed, and the church didn't have any tradition. It was a new church. What we discovered was that individuals had their own traditions, but we gradually transitioned that church into something that looked much more like a family, much more closely related. And we began to have meetings not just in the building, which in the past was my experience as a Baptist, that everything happened in the building. If you went to a prayer time, it was in the church building. The midweek Bible study was in the church building. Everything was done in the building. So it was always with that formal church atmosphere. When we started, we, after a while, began house groups midweek, which these days are commonplace. But when we started them back in the late 60s, early 70s, it was kind of revolutionary. And my former Baptist pastor, who was a dear friend, said to me, "You mustn't do that. You'll lose your church if you go into Hopes." And rather than lose your church, we began to find one another and become friends with one another. And the atmosphere of church was a great contrast to what it used to be, because you were immediately on first name terms. When you went into someone's home, you didn't sit in the back row. You're in the home, you're together. And immediately the relational factor began to change. And even when we went into our church building, when it was finished and completed, I found that initially when people started coming, now we've got a religious building, and people began to suddenly go a bit religious entering this building. And so I would deliberately arrive early. And when there were maybe 20 or 30 people gradually coming in, and you'd get that kind of hush, which we used to have, I would deliberately call out, "Hello, John, did you see the football last night?" And people would look at me, "In church." And I was deliberately killing off that formal atmosphere until everybody understood, oh, we're just friends still in this religious building. And so I deliberately tried to destroy that atmosphere. And so we began to function as friends. We related as friends. I wanted to help guys find a place of ministry as well. And so we began, we started as a church with four hymns written out in advance and a service similar to the one I used to know. But I said to them, I'd like to have times when other people can pray, other people can read scripture, other people can take part. So we began like 5 minute time in the meeting when people could take part, and then that became 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, half an hour, where it was much more spontaneous, people taking part. And we felt that was a biblical principle of people coming together, taking part together. And then I actually changed the seating, which was in rows facing the front, so that the rows were in like a horseshoe shape and we were facing inward. And then I asked some 20 men to help me start this meeting. And I got 10 fairly experienced guys and 10 inexperienced guys. I paired them up and I asked the experienced guys, "I want you to start the meeting. That means I want you to pray. I want you to select a Bible reading. I want you to choose a hymn. I want you to start the meeting." And I paired them up, a very inexperienced guy with a more experienced guy. And the understanding was, if the young guy flounders, the other guy can quickly step in. And that way, I was trying to train people, take part, select a Bible passage, select a hymn that went with it, pray. I'm trying to get people, in those very early days, I felt God spoke to me about the eagles stirring up the nest and breaking the nest so that the chicks had to fly. And the young eagles are meant to fly. And they're born up in the rock face, but you just sit there with your mouth open. If you're going to fly, the mother eagle has to break the nest. So I was trying to get them taking responsibility. And gradually, people began to grow and take on more maturity, more responsibility. And people started visiting our church, which had a kind of informality, had a different feel to other churches around. Even the local newspaper said, "Oh, look at this church, it's changed its seating arrangement." So that was news.
That was newsworthy.
That was newsworthy. Mm-hmm. And crazy. But anyway, it began to experience the presence of God and people growing. And then I was invited by somebody about 20 miles away. Would I come to their home and speak at a meeting?
Okay, let's stop here for a moment. Because I asked you what sort of organization New Frontiers is. And so far you've made it absolutely clear from the beginning you did not want it to be an organization. You want it to be a family. Is that a better word?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so here we are on the south coast of England, a church that is coming alive, is growing in depth, but numerically as well. And then you are asked to extend the family to a different location? Is that
That's exactly true. We didn't realize that was happening at the time. It was just, would I speak at a meeting, which I did. And then they said, would you come next week? And I said, no, I'm a pastor. Well, we would love to meet. What about coming every other week? And they said, we will meet every week. Will you come every other week? And I thought, actually, it'd be quite a good idea. And so I took some of the young men with me from my church as a discipling experience. So we'd talk in the way there. I would go preach and teach to people. On the way back, I could ask them, what did you make of that? How did you feel about this and that? And then the meeting began to grow. And in the end, there were people filling this man's lounge and in the hall and up the stairs. And then they actually even put money in and help the man extend his house. So the room became big enough for what became a house church. It grew in numbers and became, people traveled in to be in this place. So I'm at home and I'm there. Then a family from that church moved to another town about another 20 miles away, and they called me and said, would you come to us every other week? So I was doing alternate weeks. I filled my car with different people, and I was using it as a training program and speaking alternate weeks. Then gradually another place and another place and another place until I'm going to about 8 places around my county, all within about an hour's drive from my home base. I'm taking people with me. I'm beginning to see what were small house churches, which might be as one of the smallest was 14 people in a basement flat. They were just beginning to grow. And then eventually they began to outgrow their homes and they had to hire a hall here, a schoolroom there, and they began to grow. It wasn't an organization, it was just Terry comes to help us. That's how informal it was. And then we began to hire a large hotel in a nearby large town on a Monday night once a month and said, why don't you all come together? We'll come together once a month. So once a month we gathered in a hotel. We gathered about 250 first time, and then that grew, 350, 500. And gradually that was growing until we hired a big place in the town hall. About 1,000 people would come together on a Monday night, and these individual churches were growing up through the 100, 150, 200. And then they began to look to see, we need a building. And then also, these house churches were being cared for by the guy who lived there. It was hospitable. They had their jobs. They were not professional pastors. They had a loving care for the people. But gradually, one after another, I was feeling, maybe I should do this full time. And people began to lay down their jobs and become leaders of these growing churches.
So what sort of time scale are we talking about? You were called as a young pastor to serve on the South Coast, and now we are suddenly with between 5 and 10 growing sort of churches, groups that are outgrowing the living room and are moving into building with monthly meeting with up to 1,000 people. What's the sort of time scale we're talking about, from you starting to become a young pastor and having this sort of effect?
I became the pastor of the church in 1968. I would say it took 4 years for the home church I was working with to begin to look like what I was after in terms of a family with a meeting that was very fluid, very open, many people taking part, always with preaching and teaching. And then by about 1972, I got invited out to this other place. So that was the beginning. So it would have gone on through the 70s. So that by the end of the 70s, we had probably something like 20 churches I was working with. And I actually moved myself from this small town of Seaford into Brighton, a much bigger town, with 38 people. And we started again there. So by that time, we were growing. It would have taken that number of years. I think it was 79 or 80, I moved across to start again. So gradually we're growing. By that time, we'd started a summer camp. We hired a racetrack, Plumpton Racecourse, and we hired a circus tent, and we put on a summer camp. Unlike Keswick, where the Keswick Convention, because England has a history of camping in the summer for Christian things, but there you go as individuals. Here we came as church groups. And so each church would have its campsite. And so you came with your church. I mean, anyone could come, but it was predominantly church groups who came. And when we did our first Bible week, which was about, I think, about 78, we gathered 2,700 at our first one. And we ran that for 10 years, and that grew to 10,000. And it became called the Downs Bible Week, because that part of Sussex is the South Downs, and we just called it the Downs Bible Week, where there were large morning meetings, afternoon seminars, large evening meetings, a full day. Also, in the afternoon, there were times for young people to play sport. So it was a rounded sort of program. And people were in their tents and their trailers, their caravans, and in the British weather, which took some courage. So we ran that for 10 years, and it grew. And all the time we were beginning to become more visible. And we also...
At a certain point, you settled on the name New Frontiers. That went through a couple of stages.
That's exactly true. We initially... There was no sense of our belonging to one another. It was just Terry was helping here and Terry was helping here, and oh, we'll come together. Terry's gathering some of the full-time guys now. It was very informal. And then one day we were all praying together, and one of the guys said, I have seen a vision. I see a vision of a herd of elephants charging, and there's a jungle terrain, and they've just gone straight through. And they're going on. And he began to speak, and he said, these were his opening words, there are no well-worn paths before you. Together, you can make a road where there is no road. You can accomplish more together than you could apart. And we thought, wow, this is pretty significant. And we discussed what it meant to work together, because each of the churches by then had their own name. It might be New Life Church or Family Church or whatever name. And we said, well, what if we work together, what would be our goal and purpose? And well, God seems to be saying to us we could accomplish more together. So we were already very good friends. So I came up with about 15 values, which were like the Bible has final authority. We want to have people who disciple one another. We were all of a Baptist background. We believe in baptism. And there were some 15 values. We didn't have to rewrite the creed. We were all evangelicals. We would associate with the Evangelical Alliance Statement of Faith. We're comfortable with, we didn't have to rewrite that. But we wanted to say, this is the kind of church we will be. And so what should we call ourselves? And we felt New Frontiers reflected this concept of breaking through. So we came up with the name New Frontiers. And from that time on, every church retained its own name, but they also said, but we're part of New Frontiers. So that was quite a new step. We probably started with about 20 churches.
when did you have the first church outside the UK that became part of the New Frontiers family?
I was invited, and this was probably in the early 80s, to visit a church in Mumbai, called Bombay in those days, by a fellow who'd been a missionary out there for some 13 years and was actually associated now with a group that we were involved with in England that had become part of New Frontiers. He'd been out there, he was friendly with these people, he regarded them as home base. And he said to me, look, I've seen what you're doing among these churches. Would you have a look at the church that I've started in Bombay? And would you, look after it? What would you think? Come and see. So I went and looked at this church, and actually I thought they were fine people, but I was troubled by the elders who seemed to be not comfortable with one another, and the elders' wives, I think, hated one another. And so I said, if all the elders will stand down, I'll get involved. And to my amazement, they said, we will. They all said we'll stand down. And by that time, we had a more mature pastor and wife who made up, we had a growing team in the church that I was in Brighton. And we released him, and he went out for about 6 months and lived in Bombay, looked after that church, began to raise up fresh leadership. And most of those guys who were elders stayed, some left, most stayed. And that church became healthy and strong and secure. And I started visiting about twice a year to that church in Bombay. It was called Living Word, and it was in Bandra in Bombay. And as that became healthy and strong, they planted out Living Hope, Living Light, and other churches all around Bombay. And now we've some 50 churches in India that all grow out from that original one.
So here we have the first kind of expansion overseas. New Frontiers continued to grow into English-speaking world. How about a jump to the non-English-speaking world?
Yes, it's
true. When did that happen?
It's true that in Bombay, thoroughly English-speaking. Gradually, we went into congregations that were Hindi-speaking, but we started purely English-speaking in India. Strangely, we then made the big jump down to South Africa, where again it was English-speaking. And the next one was across into Mexico. We went long journeys initially. And when we went into Mexico, we had one young man who had gone to Mexico. He was doing a degree in Spanish, brilliant linguist, and went out to do 1 year in Mexico, fell in love with Florita, and married her, and didn't finish his degree, but became the pastor of the church, and he speaks Spanish better than the Mexicans, they say. So he would interpret for us while we were there, but he could lead brilliantly. He was like a Spanish, like a Mexican, married to a Mexican girl, his children and so on. So that was our first crossing into a new language barrier. It's only more recently, in all honesty, that we've become more involved in continental Europe. It's only more probably in the last decade that we've sent a lot of people across into continental Europe, where getting the language is the big thing. So it's interesting that the nearer ones, we had to get the language. The distance, we didn't have to.
And how large is New Frontiers by now? How many churches would consider themselves part of the New Frontiers family?
Yeah, we're not absolutely sure of the figure anymore, because it's honestly quite out there, as it were. It would be in excess of 1,500 churches around in some 70 nations. We have now, 40 years on from the story I've just told, we're now in multiplied teams who are making multiplied excursions into other nations. And at our last count, we were just over 1,500, but it's growing quite fast.
When you started out as a pastor, how big was your vision?
My longing was for revival. And when I left my secular job, I felt I'd just been reading books about revival. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones had taken a whole year out in 1959 to preach on revival for a year, celebrating the 1859 revival centenary. And revival was in our minds. We're praying for revival. And when I left work, it was with the longing that God would send revival. So my longing was for something I've yet to see. My expectation of something like this happening, I had no expectation of it. I had no thought. And even when we got started with, you know, 10, 20 churches, we're now 300 churches in the UK. I would never have dreamed that anything like that would have happened.
What brings the unity to these churches? We have Presbyterian, Baptist, and the sort of differences between them are all well known. But at the same time, it's reasonably well known what constitutes the sort of unity. How would you describe the sort of unity that forms New Frontiers?
Well, you used the word family earlier. We've had a very relational base. Everything has been on personal relationship. Initially, as I say, it was Terry coming. It wasn't that you added your name to a list. That wasn't possible. It had to be relational. You had to know one another. You couldn't just put your name on a list. You couldn't say, I'm now New Frontiers. It was impossible. It couldn't happen. You had to be in a living relationship. And some people would be coming to our meetings, getting to know us for quite a while before we would say, okay, you're part of the family. So it was always on a relational base. And even when it grew by somebody. For instance, initially it was always Terry coming. Terry would turn up. And then when it was just too many, I would say to one of the young men I'd been working with, look, I've helped you. We've seen the church established where you are now. It's healthy, it's strong. When I go, would you come with me? I'm going to this place. I'll introduce you to this man. Now, for instance, a man called David Holden. I met him when there was a group forming in his home, or his parents' home, as it happens. He was just finishing at London Bible College. I'd met him. I was very impressed with him. I wrote to him and said, would you like to come? Actually, I invited him to live with us, our family. We've always been very relational, personal. So my letter to him inviting him to come crossed with his letter to me saying, when I finish at college, I don't think I'll be ready to lead a church. And he'd seen our church. He said, I'd love to do it the way you've done it. I don't think I knew how to do that. Is there any way? And our letters, literally, it's back in the days when you wrote letters and put them in the mail, they crossed in the mail. And he got the invitation as I got the request. And he came and lived with us in our home for, I think, something like 9 months and just became part of our family, became like a son to me. And then his church prospered and went very well. And so they planted out another church. I said, look, you oversee it. You know what we would do. And then people began to look to him. And I could say, right, like Paul could say, you know Timothy, he's worked like a son with a father. Receive him like you'd receive me. And we did that sort of thing. Look, receive Dave like you'd receive me. And that began to do well. They planted churches. So he became like in a team with me. And that happened with other guys who would work closely with me. And so the whole thing was built relationally. And I would meet with these men regularly. And we all knew what was going on. We'd report back, how's it going? So everybody felt they were knowing everybody. And we would gather elders for retreat times, prayer times. We prayed together a lot. That's been very much at the center of our life together. We pray together a lot.
May I ask to be a little bit more concrete here?
Yeah.
If we talk about... forgive me the ugly term, the global leadership of New Frontiers. Is that okay term to use? Or do you feel better?
Yeah.
Talk about the global leadership of New Frontier. On an average year, would they spend
time all together praying?
We've recently, we've made a recent adjustment, so I'll come to what has been for the most of the period of time. For most of the period of time, I personally have been part of three teams. I was part of the eldership team of the Brighton Church, my home-based church. And then we had what we called a United Kingdom, a UK team, which was overseeing these United Kingdom churches. And then we'd have the international team. So there's a guy in the USA, there's a guy in Mexico, there's a guy in Ghana, there's a guy in South Africa, there's a guy in Kenya, there's a guy in India, there's a guy on Dubai. And we would gather that team like three or four times a year for two or three days. So yes, that's how it would be. So I would meet with my church team all the time, the UK team four or five times. We would also be in and out of one another's situations a lot. So that would be the senior leadership. Then the pastors would, in their regions, meet together. It started again, it's all happened organically. When I moved to Brighton, I had another fellow with me. We'd pray every Thursday morning. The church I'd left behind, the guy who'd come full-time in my place said, "Can I join you when you pray on Thursday mornings?" Yes. Another guy had come full-time. "Can I pray with you Thursday mornings?" Yes. My home, we had 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 praying every Thursday morning until we couldn't get in my home anymore. So every Thursday morning, we'd go down to our church building to pray together. By then, we had a building. And then the guys from further out, they'd all drive down to Brighton to pray on every Thursday morning until it just became too big. And so I said to David, "Why don't you peel off some to the southeast London where you are? So we won't all come to me now. Some will go there. And then others, right, will you go up there?" So we had three places where every Thursday morning pastors were praying together. And that just grew across the country. People every Thursday morning were gathering to pray. So it just grew. And it grew in prayer fellowship. We would meet together to pray. And then I was misreading a Bible passage at one time, total misread. It says, "You present your men before me three times a year, let them come empty-handed," I read. And it says, "Let them not come empty-handed." So I totally misread it. But I thought, what does it mean, come before him empty-handed? And I thought, well, it means without an agenda, without food. Some never forgave me, because what I was really looking at was the three feast days, and I read no, anyway. So we began three times a year to gather everyone who was full-time to pray for 2 days of prayer and fasting. Well, that started with about 20 people. And when I handed it all over about 5 years ago now to the next generation who now head up these various teams, we were 800. Three times a year, there were about 800. And we hired, well, we borrowed a church building in Peterborough. There's a great big church in Peterborough where Dave Smith is, Kingsgate. It's got wonderful parking lots, it's got hotels all around. And we would go and we would pray. So we pray for 2 hours, fellowship for an hour. Pray for 2 hours, fellowship for an hour. Pray for 2 hours, fellowship for an hour, right through the day. Then in the evening, I would just give a short word, go home, sleep at the hotel, come back in the morning, pray for 2 hours, fellowship for an hour, pray for 2 hours. We've done that for years. So we're together, we're praying together. Initially, when it was 20 of us, it's like one prayer meeting. As it grows to 800, you have to learn. Small group over there, sometimes we all pray together, sometimes we keep breaking it down as the day unfolds. That was a British... Well, sometimes our friends would come over from, say, Holland or from France if they wanted to come and join us. But it was essentially a UK thing, and it just grew and grew and grew. So that took many years, and it went from location to location to be able to cope with the numbers.
Now, for these things, I mean, you can't avoid some organization. For example, who would decide where the next meeting would be? I mean, you need some sort of sharing of responsibilities.
Very much so. When this whole concept of becoming new frontiers and starting a Bible week. That's a residential camp with a circus tent. And I mean, I thought, how on earth do you do that? And I knew a man who was the administrator of a thing called Chailey Heritage, a brilliant man who actually had a double degree, arts and sciences, and he was involved in the creation of limbs for thalidomide children. Brilliant man. And he had been promoted to become kind of in the management, so he was no longer doing what he loved doing. And I said to him, would you become my administrator? And he said, what does that mean? And I said, I don't really know, but I know I need you. And he said, I don't know what it means. Yes, I'm in. So he gave up his job, he moved house, and worked with me for 30 years. Wonderful man. And he administered, I'd come up with the dream, he'd make it happen. And so again and again. So by the time we did the Stoneleigh Bible Week, which we grew to, where we had nearly 30,000 people at our Bible Week every year, in the last year, I was talking to him, he said, there are 1,000 job descriptions happening during this. It was 1 week of 15,000, the second week of 15,000. He said, there are 1,000 job descriptions. Well, I didn't know one of them. He did it all, and he raised up a team of administrative people. I never did, he carried it all. And so we've had different people carrying, you know, as we grew, full-time secretaries, full-time staff had to grow.
Now, I'm speculating here, and I hope I'm wrong, but despite our best efforts to live together as family, and despite our most sincere devotion to spending a lot of time in prayer with one another, conflict happens in every family, and sometimes family members just grow away from what the family is about. Has that happened in New Frontiers? And if so, how have you coped with it?
Yes, we've had it. In God's mercy, very little we've had it. In all honesty, we've been very blessed by God. But there have been, I think, the one that comes to mind would be in one of the nations we were involved in, the guy who was leading it on our behalf was part of the international team, and it was a long way away in India, as it happens, and it would seem that all was going well, but one time I was there and it began to come to my attention that the way in which he was overseeing the churches, this growing number of churches, was very forceful and harsh, which would be the very opposite from our, we've had a grace emphasis, we've been I believe a very loving family. He had a very harsh style, and the young pastors, they were predominantly much younger pastors, and their wives indeed, were being very harshly treated. And I challenged him on it in front of some of them, the smaller group of them. And they initially said, no, this is okay, no, there are no problems. There are no problems. But I said, but... And then I said, well, look, to be honest, the style that's here, I'm not happy for that to be called New Frontiers. And so if you're happy, he's the one who's paid the price. He's the one who's moved to live here. He's married to an Indian lady, actually. He's the hardworking guy. I visit you occasionally. If you're happy, we will just withdraw because this isn't our style. And when I said that, I was literally sitting around the table and two Indian pastors were sitting either side of me around the table of about a dozen people. And they both instinctively grabbed my arm from either side and said, you mustn't leave. I said, but you said you're all happy. And then they began to say, well, and they had been so cowed that they were scared. And then it began to come out, no, actually, we are not happy. And so in the end, because I said, well, look, we'll walk away. because I honestly felt that's true. You know, he's moved, he's paid the price. But I wasn't willing for that style. It just wasn't the way we worked. And actually, we didn't lose any of the churches, but the brother no longer led. But it was probably the most painful experience. I'm saying it glibly here now. When it happened, it was one of the most painful experiences I've ever been through. It was very difficult to bear. But yeah, so yeah, we have had, to be honest, it's not like there's a long list of that, thankfully. But and I think the distance is a big thing. So this praying together, being together, yes, it was stretched at a distance. And there was a little bit of masquerading that when he would come in, it was like, oh, everything's fine. And it was only when one's actually got under the skin of things a little, it became apparent when I preached one session, and I preached about being free from fear without any angle. And I just asked people to stand who knew they were battling with fear. And I noticed all the senior men in the room were standing. And I thought, what's going on here? The senior men are expressing fear. And I noticed they're the ones who would be directly related. And I began to ask more questions. And yeah, the whole thing was governed by fear. And I later heard from other people, not other Indian pastors whom I knew and got to know more. They said, in India, New Frontiers has a terrible reputation of being very harsh. I thought, wow, we wouldn't have that reputation anywhere else in the world. So we had to deal with it.
I find it interesting that you describe this in terms of style. Because as far as I know, the New Frontiers doesn't have its own theological training for pastors, a sort of Bible school or something. I may be wrong here, so then correct me. So I would assume that theological differences would stick their head up as well.
Well, that style, as we put it, would be, if you pushed it, it would not be an embracing of the grace of God. It was a legalistic framework. We don't have a residential Bible college, but from very early on, when some of these men put down their jobs and became church pastors effectively, we immediately started a thing called Equipped for Ministry. And we did have in our ranks guys who had been either through Bible college. In fact, we had one guy who had been a Bible college lecturer. And we started Equipped for Ministry. So yes, we had our own training program, which was very thorough, and he worked out the curriculum based on what he used to do at Bible college. We had guys with degrees who are able to teach and train theologically. And then since we've gone into a number of different teams more recently, each of those places has their own. There's one that's near me now, with this guy David, whom I mentioned, who came to live with me as a young man in his 20s. He now oversees many churches in several nations, and he has what he calls his academy, which is overseen by a man called Phil Moore, who is self-taught in Greek and Hebrew, has written several Bible commentaries, and I've lectured at the academy. There are 120 guys on there at the moment doing this a two-year program on their academy. And then there's a group called Catalyst. They meet in the Midlands. Andrew Wilson from our Eastbourne church, who goes up and does a lot of the lecturing. David Devinish has done the lecturing. So different, they would all have their training programs, but people are being trained while they do the work. I went to Bible college. I would have misgivings. For 3 years, I didn't meet a sinner. I don't think it did me a lot of good. I learned a lot of information. But I felt that when Jesus trained men, he trained them with hands-on in the world. They were being trained in a living situation. Whereas I feel that the residential Bible college takes people out of a context, and you're just accumulating lots and lots of information, but at least the way we did it. And there wasn't much opportunity to express that for 3 years. I used to do evangelism virtually every day before I went to Bible college, and I had to rediscover some evangelistic zeal when I finished it. I'm much happier with guys being trained while they're also doing a level of ministry, and they go for training, and there's a program, which is thorough.
Okay, while I'm asking you next question, could I get your questions up front? So I hope somebody can collect them and bring them to us. We'll see how many questions there are. Take your time, but get the questions up here. How much freedom is there within New Frontiers on different theological perspectives? So I take it that New Frontiers is charismatic and reformed. But to what extent are, for example, are there different views on how to read Genesis 1, 2, 3, for example? To what extent are there different views on a variety of other subjects? How do you deal with this sort of potential diversity?
I would have to ask hundreds of pastors. We wouldn't have a strong line. It would be taught in the various Genesis 1 to 12, for instance, would be taught. Someone like an Andrew Wilson would teach that the opening of Genesis is essentially a poetic thing, but it is inspired, it is God's voice, God speaking. We have never defined that closely, that sort of detail.
You've given leadership in many ways. Is that a very conscious choice in sort of leaving a variety of options on a number of issues open? Sort of, okay, this is the center, and as long as you're not too far away from the center, you're part of the family. Is that conscious? Is that how it's grown? Is that part of your vision that, yes, we need to do it this way?
I think it would be true to say that it didn't. When we first established the values that we would hold together, these were not in our thoughts. And how will we interpret Genesis 1 to 12 wasn't in our thoughts. And I think that we have regarded ourselves as orthodox. I think we are together, we hold ground together. If you pressed certain details, there might be difference there. But I don't think it's affecting our practice. It's not affecting the way we serve God and build up the churches. So we've probably never made that a great detailed... We do have our teachers will meet together. We do have a kind of theological forum, and they will discuss certain matters, especially things, to be honest, that have a practical outworking. And they will discuss them, and then they will present papers to one another. Others will make comments on them. They'll be discussed more widely. And if there's a doctrine that's, for instance, the whole issue of the atonement, which came up a few years ago, we'd be very clear on our stance on that. If someone had differences on that, they would not be part of New Frontiers. So issues of what we would feel of prime significance, there would be a very clear line on that.
In a previous interview, I heard you say that two of the biggest dangers you see in younger leaders are the desire to be relevant and drifting away from biblical authority. Could you unpack that a little bit? I hope you can remember that you said it.
Yeah, I don't think I was talking about our guys at the time. I'm talking about the modern trends, which I think are out there. I think that there are attempts at the moment to be relevant. I read Os Guinness's outstanding book about the difficulties, I've forgotten the phrase now, about relevance. And sometimes an attempt to be relevant takes you away from the authority of Scripture, takes you away from the authority, because we're trying to be pleasing, we're trying, and so people adjust their stance. And I think that sometimes we have felt that evangelicalism has moved further away, or the broad scope of evangelicalism has moved away from where we all used to be. And it isn't that we've moved, we've kind of stayed still and watched other people move away. So we sometimes had to say, well, we've not drifted on that. So matters of gender and such, they were not issues when we started New Frontiers. And they never have been issues to us, but it's become an issue in the broader body. So we have to kind of restate where we are, not because we've changed, but because it seems as though other people have changed and we're holding common ground, central ground.
Yep. What are the most important practices you would mention which would help young ministers stay in ministry for decades?
Yes. I think that your personal enjoyment of God is fundamental. And I've often been asked questions like this because, you know, I've been around for a long time. And people say, how do you keep going, as it were? And I always feel that George Mueller, that great man of faith of a previous generation, he said, I see it as my chief duty, and you might say, well, finish that sentence, is to feed hundreds of orphans. But he didn't. He said, my chief duty every day is to make sure my soul is happy in God. And I thoroughly agree. And I've often felt that scripture, keep yourself in the love of God, is a fundamental. I've sometimes used the illustration of when you're on an airplane, quite early on they'll go through the normal procedures and they'll say, if there's a problem with oxygen, the oxygen mask will fall. And they say, put the mask on yourself first. And if you have a child with you or a dependent relative, put it on them second. And you might say, well, hey, no, this is my little boy. I'm looking after him first. He comes first in my life. But they know what they're talking about because you're trying to put the mask on little Johnny. And little Johnny says, I don't want it. And you're meanwhile beginning, hey, you know, no, put it on yourself first. And if you're a pastor, it's a bit like being a doctor sometimes. People come to you when they're sick, when they're in pain, they're in difficulty, and you are absorbing a lot of pain. You have disappointments, you have setbacks, you have all kinds of pressures. If you don't know how to keep yourself in the love of God, if you don't know how to keep your soul happy in God, you will be in serious trouble. And when I first left Bible college, you would be sent details of all the people in your year for a few years that happened. And as the years went by, the list of men still in ministry got shorter and shorter and shorter. It went down to a handful against a complete year. And people, it's tough being a leader and serving the flock of God. And if you don't know how to keep your own soul nourished, then you're in serious trouble. So I would say that, to me, is number one, to feed yourself in the Word of God, to enjoy the presence of God, to celebrate your adoption as a son, to worship God. So for me, each day, you'll find me worshiping. And I remember I wrote on a little card and stuck it on my wall, are you kneeling worshiping or standing worrying? And I built that into my soul, and it's the sort of thing John Piper was preaching here this morning, or yesterday morning, about celebrating God, learning to find contentment in Him. It's so important. What would be my advice to a young pastor? Find your contentment in Him and make sure that Jesus is enough for you. Everything else falls into the right proportion.
Okay, we're going to do two questions in 3 minutes.
Okay.
And one of the questions is about time management. With all the different responsibilities and demands on your time, what was your actual practice of time management? How do you devote your time? So show us an example in giving us a very short answer.
It's very difficult to give a short answer because my time is, my weeks can be so contrasting. I can be flying to Mexico. I can be flying to India, I could be at home for a week. It's very, very different. So it's making sure the ultimate values are always in place, because my lifestyle has been quite complicated for decades, in that I could be away, I can be at home. So as long as the vital principles are in place, for me, that's the priority. But my days, I'm here for 6 days. Next month, I'm in 4 different locations at different settings. So for me, it's getting the major blocks in place. And I once heard this illustration, if we have time for it. I believe I heard it from a business situation. A guy in my church said that they had somebody who came to teach them as executives, and he put a bucket in front of them all. And he said he put stones in the bucket. And then he said to the executives, "Is the bucket full?" And they said, some said yes, some said no. And he said, "What do you mean it's not full?" And they said, "Well, you could get some shingle." "That's right, you've got another bucket, put some shingle in among the rocks. Now is it full?" "And yes or no?" "No, it's not full." "He put some sand in, he could just get sand. Is it full now?" "No, it's not. You could put some water in it now." "Now, is it full now?" "Okay, it's full. What did you learn?" He said, "This is what you learned. If you didn't get the big rocks in first, you'd never get them in." And I thought it was so helpful. You get the major things in and build around the major things. So the time management, get the major things. For me, life is too complicated to have a model day. I don't have a model day.
Thank you very much. And final question. You have seen hundreds of churches grow up from sometimes very small beginnings, living room, to become flourishing churches, even with their own building and multiple paid staff, etc. What is the common practice that defines all those churches that grow up? So what is the essential element, or what are the essential elements that characterize those churches that grow up?
I think that always the Word of God is central, it's fundamental, it's authoritative, it is constantly preached, the flock are fed with the Word of God. Prayer, churches are built on prayer, they're encouraged to give themselves to prayer, to see prayer as fundamental. Open, honest relationships are of huge importance, openness to one another. We don't have a formality figure, we don't have a kind of formal hierarchy. We respect leadership, we respect gifting. We try to build teams so that churches don't have just one guy, but a group as soon as possible, a group of elders, a team. Yes, there will be a team leader, but we function as teams. These would be of fundamental importance. We're trying to be relevant to our generation without losing the gospel. These would be hugely valuable to our people. We're here for the nations. We're on world mission together. So a local church isn't an end in itself. And that's where we've found being a family of churches on world mission is so helpful, because we'll find people will be raised up in the churches. They may find themselves in India or Mexico or Africa in days ahead, because we're on a mission together. We're not just a domestic community. We want to serve this town, but we also know we're serving the nations. We will have exposure to people coming in and out from nations to keep us aware of the nations. These are some of the ingredients. I could go on, but those would be some of the major ones.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, sharing your wisdom, and giving us so generous of your time. So, God bless.
Thank you so much. Thank you.